I shouldn't have banished him. I should have kept him, or I should have killed him. She played at being a queen, yet sometimes she still felt like a scared little girl. Viserys always said what a dolt I was. Was he truly mad? She closed the book. She could still recall Ser Jorah, if she wished, or send Dario to kill him. Dany fled from the choice, out onto the terrace. She found Rhaegal asleep beside the pool, a green and bronze coil basking in the sun. Drogon was perched up atop the pyramid, in the place where the huge bronze harpy had stood before she had commanded it to be pulled down. He spread his wings and roared when he spied her. There was no sign of Viserion, but when she went to the parapet and scanned the horizon, she saw pale wings in the far distance, sweeping above the river. He is hunting. They grow bolder every day. Yet it still made her anxious when they flew too far away. One day, one of them may not return, she thought.
Your Grace!
She turned to find Sir Barristan behind her. What more would you have of me, sir? I spared you. I took you into my service. Now give me some peace.
Forgive me, Your Grace. It was only... Now that you know who I am...
The old man hesitated.
A knight of the King's Guard is in the King's presence day and night. For that reason, our vows require us to protect his secrets as we would his life. But your father's secrets, by rights, belong to you now, along with his throne, and I thought, perhaps, you might have questions for me.
Questions? She had 100 questions, 1,000, 10,000. Why couldn't she think of one? Was my father truly mad? She blurted out. Why did I ask that? Viserys said this talk of madness was a ploy of the usurpers.
Viserys was a child, and the queen sheltered him as much as she could. Your father always had a little madness in him, I now believe. Yet he was charming. And generous as well, so his lapses were forgiven. His reign began with such promise, but as the years passed, the lapses grew more frequent until...
Danny stopped him. Do I want to hear this now? Sir Barristan considered a moment.
Perhaps not. Not now.
Not now, she agreed. One day you must tell me all, the good and the bad. There is some good to be said of my father, surely.
There is, Your Grace, of him and those who came before him. Your grandfather, Jaehaerys, and his brother, their father Aegon, your mother, and Rhaegar, him most of all.
I wish I could have known him. Her voice was wistful.
I wish he could have known you, the old knight said. When you are ready, I will tell you all.
Dany kissed him on the cheek and sent him on his way. That night her handmaids brought her lamb, with a salad of raisins and carrots soaked in wine, and a hot flaky bread dripping with honey. She could eat none of it. Did Rhaegar ever grow so weary? She wondered. Did Aegon, after his conquest? Later, when the time came for sleep, Dany took Eri into bed with her. For the first time since the ship. But even as she shuddered in release and wound her fingers through her handmaid's thick black hair, she pretended it was Drogo holding her. Only somehow his face kept turning into Dario's. If I want Dario, I need only say so. She lay with Iri's legs entangled in her own. His eyes looked almost purple today. Danny's dreams were dark that night, and she woke 3 times from half-remembered nightmares. After the 3rd time, she was too restless to return to sleep. Moonlight streamed through the slanting windows, silvering the marble floors. A cool breeze was blowing through the open terrace doors. Eri slept soundly beside her, her lips slightly parted, one dark brown nipple peeping out above the sleeping silks. For a moment Danny was tempted. But it was Drogo she wanted, or perhaps Dario, not Eri. The maid was sweet and skilful, but all her kisses tasted of duty. She rose, leaving Iria asleep in the moonlight. Jiqui and Missandei slept in their own beds. Danae slipped on a robe and padded barefoot across the marble floor out onto the terrace. The air was chilly, but she liked the feel of grass between her toes and the sound of the leaves whispering to one another. Wind ripples chased each other across the surface of the little bathing pool and made the moon's reflection dance and shimmer. She leaned against a low brick parapet to look down upon the city. Marine was sleeping too. Lost in dreams of kinder days, perhaps? Night covered the streets like a black blanket, hiding the corpses and the grey rats that came up from the sewers to feast on them, the swarms of stinging flies. Distant torches glimmered red and yellow where her sentries walked their rounds, and here and there she saw the faint glow of lanterns bobbing down an alley. Perhaps one was Sir Jorah, leading his horse slowly toward the gate. Farewell, old bear. Farewell, betrayer. She was Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Khaleesi and Queen, Mother of Dragons, Slayer of Warlocks, Breaker of Chains, and there was no one in the world that she could trust.
Your Grace!
Missandei stood at her elbow, wrapped in a bedrobe, wooden sandals on her feet.
I awoke and saw that you were gone. Did you sleep well? What are you looking at?
My city, said Danny. I was looking for a house with a red door, but by night all the doors are black.
A red door? Missandei was puzzled. What house is this?
No house. It does not matter. Danny took the younger girl by the hand. Never lie to me, Missandei. Never betray me.
I never would, Missandei promised. Look, dawn comes.
The sky had turned a cobalt blue from the horizon to the zenith, and behind the line of low hills to the east, a glow could be seen, pale gold and oyster pink. Danny held Missandei's hand as they watched the sun come up. All the grey bricks became red and yellow and blue and green and orange. The scarlet sands of the fighting pits transformed them into bleeding sores before her eyes. Elsewhere, the golden dome of the Temple of the Graces blazed bright, and bronze stars winked along the walls where the light of the rising sun touched the spikes on the helms of the Unsullied. On the terrace, a few flies stirred sluggishly. A bird began to chirp in the persimmon tree, and then two more. Danny cocked her head to hear their song, but it was not long before the sounds of the waking city drowned them out. The sounds of my city. That morning she summoned her captains and commanders to the garden rather than descending to the audience chamber. Aegon the Conqueror brought fire and blood to Westeros, but afterward he gave them peace, prosperity, and justice. But all I have brought to Slaver's Bay is death and ruin. I have been more Carl than Queen, smashing and plundering than moving on.
There is nothing to stay for, said Brown Ben Plum.
Your Grace, the slavers brought their doom on themselves, said Dario Naharis.
You have brought freedom as well, Missandei pointed out.
Freedom to starve? Danny asked sharply. Freedom to die? Am I a dragon or a harpy? Am I mad? Do I have the taint?
A dragon,
Sir Barristan said with certainty.
Marine is not Westeros, Your Grace.
But how can I rule seven kingdoms if I cannot rule a single city? He had no answer to that. Danny turned away from them to gaze out over the city once again. My children need time to heal and learn. My dragons need time to grow and test their wings, and I need the same. I will not let this city go the way of Astapor. I will not let the Harpier of Yunkai chain up those I've freed all over again. She turned back to look at their faces. I will not march, "What will you do then?" Khaleesi asked Ricaro. "Stay," she said, "rule, and be a queen."
Daenerys. The land was red and dead and parched, and good wood was hard to come by. Her foragers returned with gnarled cottonwoods, purple brush, sheaves of brown grass. They took the two straightest trees, hacked the limbs and branches from them, skinned off their bark, and split them, laying the logs in a square. Its center they filled with straw, brush, bark shavings, and bundles of dry grass. Ricaro chose a stallion from the small herd that remained to them. He was not the equal of Khal Drogo's Red, but few horses were. In the center of the square, Aego fed him a withered apple and dropped him in an instant with an axe blow between the eyes. Bound hand and foot, Miramar's Dor watched from the dust with disquiet in her black eyes.
"It's not enough to kill a horse," she told Danny. "By itself, the blood is nothing. You do not have the words to make a spell, nor the wisdom to feign them. Do you think blood magic is a game for children? You call me Meiji, as if it were a curse. But all it means is wise. You are a child with a child's ignorance. Whatever you mean to do, it will not work. Loose me from these bonds, and I will help you."
"I am tired of the Meiji's braying," Danny told Joga. He took his whip to her, and after that the god's wife kept silent. Over the carcass of the horse, they built a platform of hewn logs, trunks of smaller trees and limbs from the greater, and the thickest, straightest branches they could find. They laid the wood east to west from sunrise to sunset. On the platform they piled Khal Drogo's treasures, his great tent, his painted vests, his saddles and harness, the whip his father had given him when he came to manhood, the arrack he had used to slay Khal Ogo and his son, a mighty dragonbone bow. Aego would have added the weapons Drogo's blood riders had given Danny for bride gifts as well, but she forbade it. "Those are mine," she told them, "and I mean to keep them." Another layer of brush was piled about the Khal's treasures, and bundles of dried grass scattered over them. Sir Jorah Mormont drew her aside as the sun was creeping toward its zenith.
"Princess," he began.
"Why do you call me that?" Danny challenged him. "My brother Viserys was your king, was he not?"
"He was, my lady."
"Viserys is dead. I am his heir, the last blood of House Targaryen. Whatever was his is mine now."
"My queen,"
Sir Jorah said, going to one knee.
"My sword that was his is yours, Daenerys, and my heart as well. That never belonged to your brother. I am only a knight, and I have nothing to offer you but exile. But I beg you, hear me. Let Khal Drogo go. You shall not be alone. I promise you no man shall take you to Vaes Dothrak unless you wish to go. You need not join the Dosh Kleen. Come east with me. Geaty, Kaas, the Jade Sea, Ashai by the Shadow. We will see all the wonders yet unseen, and drink what wines the gods see fit to serve us. Please, Khaleesi, I know what you intend. Do not. Do not."
"I must," Danny told him. She touched his face fondly, sadly. "You do not understand."
"Well, I understand that you loved him," Sir Jorah said in a voice thick with despair. "I loved my lady wife once, yet I did not die with her. You are my queen. My sword is yours, but do not ask me to stand aside as you climb on Drogo's pyre. I will not watch you burn."
"Is that what you fear?" Danny kissed him lightly on his broad forehead. "I am not such a child as that, sweet sir."
"You do not mean to die with him? You swear it, my queen?"
"I swear it," she said in the common tongue of the seven kingdoms that by rights were hers. The third level of the platform was woven of branches no thicker than a finger, and covered with dry leaves and twigs. They laid them north to south, from ice to fire, and piled them high with soft cushions and sleeping silks. The sun had begun to lower towards the west by the time they were done. Danny called the Dothraki around her. Fewer than 100 were left. How many had Aegon started with, she wondered. It did not matter. "You will be my Khalasar," she told them. "I see the faces of slaves. I free you. Take off your colors. Go if you wish. No one shall harm you. If you stay, it will be as brothers and sisters, husbands and wives." The black eyes watched her, wary, expressionless. "I see the children, women, the wrinkled faces of the aged. I was a child yesterday. Today I am a woman. Tomorrow I will be old. To each of you I say, give me your hands and your hearts, and there will always be a place for you." She turned to the three young warriors of her cause. "Jogo, to you I give the silver-handled whip that was my bride gift, and name you Ko, and ask your oath, that you will live and die as blood of my blood, riding at my side to keep me safe from harm." Jogo took the whip from her hands, but his face was confused.
"Khaleesi," he said hesitantly, "this is not done. It would shame me to be blood rider to a woman."
"Aego," Danny called, paying no attention to Jogo's words,
"if I look back, I am lost.
To you I give the dragonbone bow that was my bride gift. It was double-curved, shiny black, and exquisite, taller than she was. I name you Ko, and ask your oath that you should live and die as blood of my blood, riding at my side to keep me safe from harm." Aego accepted the bow with lowered eyes.
"I cannot say these words. Only a man can lead a Khalasar or name a Ko."
"Rakharo," Danny said, turning away from the refusal, "you shall have the great Arrak that was my bride gift, with hilt and blade chased in gold. And you too I name my Ko, and ask you to live and die as blood of my blood, riding at my side to keep me safe from harm."
"You are Khaleesi," Rakharo said, taking the Arrak. "I shall ride at your side to Vaiz Dathrak, beneath the Mother of Mountains, and keep you safe from harm until you take your place with the crones of the Dushkaleen. No more can I promise."
She nodded, as calmly as if she had not heard his answer, and turned to the last of her champions. "Sir Jorah Mormont," she said, "first and greatest of my knights, I have no bride gift to give you, but I swear to you one day you shall have from my hands a longsword like none the world has ever seen, dragon-forged and made of Valyrian steel, and I would ask for your oath as well."
"You have it, my queen," Sir Jorah said, kneeling to lay his sword at her feet. "I vow to serve you, to obey you, and to die for you if need be."
"Whatever may come?"
"Whatever may come.
I shall hold you to that oath. I pray you never regret the giving of it." Danny lifted him to his feet. Stretching on her toes to reach his lips, she kissed the knight gently and said, "You are the first of my queen's guard." She could feel the eyes of the Khalasar on her as she entered her tent. The Dothraki were muttering and giving her strange sideways looks from the corners of their dark almond eyes. They thought her mad, Danny realized. Perhaps she was. She would know soon enough. "If I look back, I am lost." Her bath was scalding hot when Iri helped her into the tub, but Danny did not flinch or cry aloud. She liked the heat. It made her feel clean. Jiqui had scented the water with the oil she had found in the market in Vase Dothrak. The steam rose moist and fragrant. Doria washed her hair and combed it out, working loose the mats and tangles. Iri scrubbed her back. Danny closed her eyes and let the smell and the warmth enfold her. She could feel the heat soaking through the soreness between her thighs. She shuddered when it entered her, and her pain and stiffness seemed to dissolve. She floated. When she was clean, her handmaids helped her from the water. Iri and Jiqui fanned her dry, while Doria brushed her hair until it fell like a river of liquid silver down her back. They scented her with spiced flour and cinnamon, a touch on each wrist, behind her ears, on the tips of her milk-heavy breasts. The last dab was for her sex. Iri's finger felt as light and cool as a lover's kiss as it slid softly up between her lips. Afterward, Danny sent them all away, so she might prepare Khal Drogo for his final ride into the Nightlands. She washed his body clean and brushed and oiled his hair, running her fingers through it for the last time, feeling the weight of it, remembering the first time she had touched it, the night of their wedding ride. His hair had never been cut. How many men could die with their hair uncut? She buried her face in it and inhaled the dark fragrance of the oils. He smelled like grass and warm earth, like smoke and semen and horses. He smelled like Drogo. "Forgive me, son of my life," she thought. "Forgive me for all I have done and all I must do. I paid the price, my star, but it was too high, too high." Danny braided his hair and slid the silver rings onto his moustache and hung the bells one by one. So many bells, gold and silver and bronze. Bells so his enemies would hear him coming and grow weak with fear. She dressed him in horsehair leggings and high boots, buckling a belt heavy with gold and silver medallions about his waist. Over his scarred chest, she slipped a painted vest, old and faded, the one Drogo had loved best. For herself, she chose loose sand-silk trousers, sandals that laced halfway up her legs, and a vest like Drogo's. The sun was going down when she called them back to carry the body to the pyre. The Dothraki watched in silence as Jogo and Ego bore him from the tent. Danny walked behind them. They laid him down on his cushions and silks, his head towards the Mother of Mountains far to the northeast. "Oil," she commanded, and they brought forth the jars and poured them over the pyre, soaking the silks and the brush and the bundles of dry grass, until the oil trickled from beneath the logs and the air was rich with fragrance. "Bring my eggs," Danny commanded her handmaids. Something in her voice made them run. Ser Jorah took her arm. "My queen, Drogo will have no use for dragon's eggs in the Nightlands. Better to sell them in Ashayi. Sell one and we can buy a ship to take us back to the free cities. Sell all three, and you'll be a wealthy woman all your days."
"They were not given to me to sell," Danny told him. She climbed the pyre herself to place the eggs around her sun and stars, the black beside his heart, under his arm, the green beside his head, his braid coiled around it, the cream and gold down between his legs. When she kissed him for the last time, Danny could taste the sweetness of the oil on his lips. As she climbed down off the pyre, she noticed Miramazdur watching her.
"You are mad,"
the god's wife said hoarsely. "Is it so far from madness to wisdom?" Danny asked. "Ser Jorah, take this Meiji and bind her to the pyre."
My queen, no, hear me.
Do as I say." Still he hesitated until her anger flared. "You swore to obey me, whatever might come. Rakaro, help him." The god's wife did not cry out as they dragged her to Khal Drogo's pyre and staked it down amidst his treasures. Danny poured the oil over the woman's head herself. "I thank you, Miramazdur," she said, "for the lessons you have taught me."
"You will not hear me scream,"
Mira responded, as the oil dripped from her hair and soaked her clothing. "I will," Danny said, "but it's not your screams I want, only your life. I remember what you told me. Only death can pay for life." Miramazdur opened her mouth, but made no reply. As she stepped away, Danny saw that the contempt was gone from the mage's flat black eyes. In its place was something that might have been fear. Then there was nothing to be done but watch the sun and look for the first star. When a horse lord dies, his horse is slain with him, so he might ride proud into the nightlands. The bodies are burned beneath the open sky, and the carl rises on his fiery steed to take his place among the stars. The more fiercely the man burned in life, the brighter his star will shine in the darkness. Jogo spied it first. "There," he said, in a hushed voice. Danny looked and saw it, low in the east. The first star was a comet, burning red, blood red, fire red, the dragon's tail. She could not have asked for a stronger sign. Danny took the torch from Aegir's hand and thrust it between the logs. The oil took the fire at once, the brush and dried grass a heartbeat later. Tiny flames went darting up the wood like swift red mice, skating over the oil and leaping from bark to branch to leaf. A rising heat puffed at her face, soft and sudden as a lover's breath, but in seconds it had grown too hot to bear. Danny stepped backward. The wood crackled louder and louder. Miramazdur began to sing in a shrill, ululating voice. The flames whirled and writhed, racing each other up the platform. The dusk shimmered as the air itself seemed to liquefy from the heat. Danny heard logs split and crack. The fires swept over Miramazdur. Her song grew louder, shriller. Then she gasped again and again, and her song became a shuddering wail, thin and high and full of agony. And now the flames reached her Drogo, and now they were all around him. His clothing took fire, and for an instant the carl was clad in wisps of floating orange silk and tendrils of curling smoke, grey and greasy. Danny's lips parted, and she found herself holding her breath. Part of her wanted to go to him, as Ser Jorah had feared, to rush into the flames, to beg for his forgiveness, and take him inside her one last time, the fire melting the flesh from their bones until they were as one forever. She could smell the odour of burning flesh, no different from horse flesh roasting in a fire pit. The pyre roared in the deepening dusk like some great beast, drowning out the fainter sounds of Miramazdur's screaming, and sending up long tongues of flame to lick at the belly of the night. As the smoke grew thicker, the Dothraki backed away, coughing. Huge orange gouts of fire unfurled their banners in that hellish wind, the logs hissing and cracking, glowing cinders rising on the smoke to float away into the dark like so many newborn fireflies. The heat beat at the air with great red wings, driving the Dothraki back, driving off even Mormont. But Danny stood her ground. She was the blood of the dragon, and the fire was in her. She had sensed the truth of it long ago, Danny thought, as she took a step closer to the conflagration, but the brazier had not been hot enough. The flames writhed before her like the women who had danced at her wedding, whirling and singing and spinning their yellow and orange and crimson veils, fearsome to behold, yet lovely, so lovely, alive with heat. Danny opened her arms to them, her skin flushed and glowing. "This is a wedding too," she thought. Miramazdur
had fallen silent. The guard's wife thought her a child. But children grow, and children learn. Another step, and Danny could feel the heat of the sand on the soles of her feet, even through her sandals. Sweat ran down her thighs and between her breasts, and in rivulets over her cheeks, where tears had once run. Sir Jorah was shouting behind her, but he did not matter any more. Only the fire mattered. The flames were so beautiful, the loveliest thing she had ever seen, each one a sorcerer robed in yellow and orange and scarlet, swirling long, smoky cloaks. She saw crimson fire lions and great yellow serpents and unicorns made of pale blue flame. She saw fish and foxes and monsters, wolves and bright birds and flowering trees, each more beautiful than the last. She saw a horse, a great grey stallion, limned in smoke, its flowing mane a nimbus of blue flame. "Yes, my love, my sun and stars, yes, mount now, ride now." Her vest had begun to smoulder, so Danny shrugged it off and let it fall to the ground. The painted leather burst into sudden flame as she skipped closer to the fire, her breast bare to the blaze, streams of milk flowing from her red and swollen nipples. "Now," she thought, "now." And for an instant she glimpsed Khal Drogo before her, mounted on his smoky stallion, a flaming lash in his hand. He smiled, and the whip snaked down at the pyre, hissing. She heard a crack, a sound of shattering stone. The platform of wood and brush and grass began to shift and collapse in upon itself. Bits of burning wood slid down at her. Danny was showered with ash and cinders, and something else came crashing down, bouncing and rolling to land at her feet. A chunk of curved rock, pale and veined with gold, broken and smoking. The roaring filled the world. Yet dimly through the firefall, Danny heard women shriek and children cry out in wonder. Only death can pay for life. And there came a second crack, loud and sharp as thunder, and the smoke stirred and whirled around her, and the pyre shifted, the logs exploding as the fire touched their secret hearts. She heard the screams of frightened horses, and the voices of the Dothraki raised in shouts of fear and terror, and Sir Jorah calling her name and cursing. "No," she wanted to shout to him. "No, my good knight, do not fear for me. The fire is mine. I am Daenerys Stormborn, daughter of dragons, bride of dragons, mother of dragons. Don't you see? Don't you see?" With a belch of flame and smoke that reached 30 feet into the sky, the pyre collapsed and came down around her. Unafraid, Danny stepped forward into the firestorm, calling to her children. The third crack was as loud and sharp as the breaking of the world. When the fire died at last, and the ground became cool enough to walk upon, Sir Jorah Mormont found her amidst the ashes, surrounded by blackened logs and bits of glowing ember and the burnt bones of man and woman and stallion. She was naked, covered with soot, her clothes turned to ash, her beautiful hair all crisped away. Yet she was unhurt. The cream and gold dragon was suckling at her left breast, the green and bronze at the right. Her arms cradled them close. The black and scarlet beast was draped across her shoulders, its long, sinuous neck coiled under her chin. When it saw Jorah, it raised its head and looked at him with eyes as red as coals. Wordless, the knight fell to his knees. The men of her cars
came up behind him. Jogo was the first to lay his arrack at her feet. "Blood of my blood," he murmured, pushing his face to the smoking earth. "Blood of my blood," she heard Ego echo. "Blood of my blood," Rakaro shouted. And after them came a handmaids, and then the others, all the Dothraki men and women and children, and Danny had only to look at their eyes to know that they were hers, now, today, and tomorrow, and forever. Hers, as they had never been Drogo's. As Daenerys Targaryen rose to her feet, her black hissed, pale smoke venting from its mouth and nostrils, the other two pulled away from her breasts and added their voices to the call, translucent wings unfolding and stirring the air. And for the first time, in hundreds of years, the night came alive with the music of dragons.
Epilogue. "I'm no traitor," the Knight of Griffin's Roost declared. "I am King Tommen's man, and yours." A steady drip, drip, drip punctuated his words, as snow melt ran off his cloak to puddle on the floor. The snow had been falling on King's Landing most of the night. Outside, the drifts were ankle deep. Sir Kevin Lannister pulled his cloak about himself more closely. "So you say, sir. Words are wind."
"Then let me prove the truth of them with my sword."
The light of the torches made a fiery blaze of Runet Cunnington's long red hair and beard.
"Send me against my uncle, and I will bring you back his head, and the head of this false dragon too."
Lannister spearmen in crimson cloaks and lion-crested half-helms stood along the west wall of the throne room. Tyrell guards in green cloaks faced them from the opposite wall. The chill in the throne room was palpable. Though neither Queen Cersei nor Queen Margaery was amongst them, their presence could be felt poisoning the air, like ghosts at a feast. Behind the table, where the five members of the King's Small Council were seated, the Iron Throne crouched like some great black beast, its barbs and claws and blades half shrouded in shadow. Kevin Lannister could feel it at his back, an itch between the shoulder blades. It was easy to imagine old King Aerys perched up there, bleeding from some fresh cut, glowering down. But today the throne was empty. He had seen no reason for Tommen to join them. Kinder to let the boy remain with his mother. The Seven only knew how long mother and son might have together before Cersei's trial, and possibly her execution. Mace Tyrell was speaking. "We shall deal with your uncle and his feigned boy in due time." The new king's hand was seated on an oaken throne carved in the shape of a hand, an absurd vanity his lordship had produced the day Sir Kevin agreed to grant him the office he coveted. "You will bide here until we are ready to march. Then you shall have the chance to prove your loyalty." Sir Kevin took no issue with that. "Escort Sir Runnett back to his chambers," he said. "And see that he remains there," went unspoken. However loud his protestations, the Knight of Griffin's Roost remained suspect. Supposedly the sellswords who had landed in the south were being led by one of his own blood. As the echoes of Cunnington's footsteps faded away, Grand Maester Pycelle gave a ponderous shake of his head.
"His uncle once stood just where the boy was standing now and told King Aerys how he would deliver him, the head of Robert Baratheon."
"That is how it is when a man grows as old as Pycelle. Everything you see or hear reminds you of something you saw or heard when you were young." "How many men-at-arms accompanied Sir Runnett to the city?" Sir Kevin asked.
20, said Lord Randall Tarley, "and most of them Gregor Clegane's old lot. Your nephew Jamie gave them to Connington to rid himself of them, I'd wager. They had not been in Maidenpool a day before one killed a man, and another was accused of rape. I had to hang the one and gel the other. If it were up to me, I would send them all to the Night's Watch, and Connington with them. The Wall is where such scum belong. A dog takes after its master, declared Mace Tyrrell. Black cloaks would suit them, I agree. I will not suffer such men in the city watch. 100 of his own High Garden men had been added to the gold cloaks, yet plainly his lordship meant to resist any balancing infusion of Westerman. The more I give him, the more he wants. Kevin Lannister was beginning to understand why Cersei had grown so resentful of the Tyrells. But this was not the moment to provoke an open quarrel. Randall Tarly and Mace Tyrell had both brought armies to King's Landing, whilst the best part of the strength of House Lannister remained in the Riverlands, fast melting away. The Mountain's men were always fighters, he said in a conciliatory tone, and we may have need of every sword against these sellswords. If this truly is the Golden Company, as Qyburn's whisperers insist, call them what you will, said Randall Tarly. They are still no more than adventurers. Perhaps, Sir Kevin said. But the longer we ignore these adventurers, the stronger they grow. We have had a map prepared, a map of the incursions. Grandmaster? The map was beautiful, painted by a master's hand on a sheet of the finest vellum, so large it covered the table.
Here,
Pycelle pointed with a spotted hand. Where the sleeve of his robe rode up, a flap of pale flesh could be seen dangling beneath his forearm.
Here and here, all along the coast and on the islands. Toss the Stepstones, even Estermont. And now we have reports that Connington is moving on Storm's End.
If it is John Connington, said Randall Tarly. Storm's End, Lord Mace Tyrell grunted the words. He cannot take Storm's End, not if he were Aegon the Conqueror. And if he does, what of it? Stannis holds it now. Let the castle pass from one pretender to another. Why should that trouble us? I shall recapture it after my daughter's innocence is proved. How can you recapture it when you have never captured it to begin with? I understand, my lord, but Tyrell did not let him finish. These charges against my daughter are filthy lies. I ask again, why must we play out this mummer's farce? Have King Tommen declare my daughter innocent, sir, and put an end to the foolishness here and now. Do that, and the whispers will follow Margaery the rest of her life. No man doubts your daughter's innocence, my lord, Sir Kevin lied. But His High Holiness insists upon a trial. Lord Randall snorted. What have we become when kings and high lords must dance to the twittering of sparrows? We have foes on every hand, Lord Tarly, Sir Kevin reminded him. Stannis in the north, Ironmen in the west, sellswords in the south. Defy the High Septon, and we will have blood running in the gutters of King's Landing as well. If we are seen to be going against the guards, it will only drive the pious into the arms of one or the other of these would-be usurpers. Mace Tyrell remained unmoved. Once Paxter Redwine sweeps the Iron Men from the seas, my sons will retake the shields. The Snows will do for Stannis, or Bolton will. As for Connington, if it is him, Lord Randall said. As for Connington, Tyrell repeated. What victories has he ever won that we should fear him? He could have ended Robert's rebellion at Stony Sept. He failed. just as the Golden Company has always failed. Some may rush to join them, aye. The realm is well rid of such fools. Sir Kevin wished that he could share his certainty. He had known John Connington, slightly, a proud youth, the most headstrong of the gaggle of young lordlings who had gathered round Prince Rhaegar Targaryen, competing for his royal favour. Arrogant, but able and energetic. That and his skill at arms was why Mad King Aerys had named him Hand. Old Lord Merryweather's inaction had allowed the rebellion to take root and spread, and Aerys wanted someone young and vigorous to match Robert's own youth and vigour. "Too soon," Lord Tywin Lannister had declared when word of the king's choice had reached Casterly Rock. "Connington is too young, too bold, too eager for glory." The Battle of the Bells had proved the truth of that. Sir Kevin had expected that afterward Aerys would have no choice but to summon Tywin once more. But the Mad King had turned to the Lords Chelstead and Rossart instead, and paid for it with life and crown. That was all so long ago, though. If this is indeed John Connington, he will be a different man, older, harder, more seasoned, more dangerous. Connington may have more than the Golden Company. It is said he has a Targaryen pretender. "A fiend boy is what he has," said Randall Tarley. "That may be or not. Kevin Lannister had been here, in this very hall, when Tywin had laid the bodies of Prince Rhaegar's children at the foot of the Iron Throne, wrapped up in crimson cloaks. The girl had been recognisably the Princess Rhaenys, but the boy, a faceless horror of bone and brain and gore, a few hanks of fair hair, none of us looked long. Tywin said that it was Prince Aegon, and we took him at his word. We have these tales coming from the east as well. A second Targaryen, and one whose blood no man can question. Daenerys Stormborn. As mad as her father, declared Lord Mace Tyrell. That would be the same father that Highgarden and House Tyrell supported to the bitter end and well beyond. Mad she may be, Sir Kevin said. But with so much smoke drifting west, surely there must be some fire burning in the east? Grand Maester Pycelle bobbed his head.
Dragons, these same stories have reached Oldtown. Too many to discount. A silver-haired queen with three dragons.
At the far end of the world, said Mace Tyrell, Queen of Slaver's Bay, aye. She's welcome to it. On that we can agree, Sir Kevin said. But the girl is of the blood of Aegon the Conqueror, and I do not think she will be content to remain in Meereen forever. If she should reach these shores and join her strength to Lord Connington and this prince of his, feigned or no, we must destroy Connington and his pretender now, before Daenerys Stormborn can come west. Mace Tyrell crossed his arms. I mean to do just that, sir. After the trials.
Sell swords, fight for coin,
declared Grand Maester Pycelle.
With enough gold, we might persuade the Golden Company to hand over Lord Connington and the pretender.
Aye, if we had gold, Sir Harris Swift said. Alas, my lord. Our vaults contain only rats and roaches. I have written again to the Meerish bankers. If they will agree to make good the Crown's debt to the Bravassi and extend us a new loan, mayhaps we will not have to raise the taxes. Elsewise, the magisters of Pentos have been known to lend money as well, said Sir Kevin. Try them. The Pentoshi were even less like to be of help than the Meerish money changers. But the effort must be made. Unless a new source of coin could be found, or the Iron Bank persuaded to relent, he would have no choice but to pay the Crown's debts with Lannister gold. he dare not resort to new taxes. Not with the Seven Kingdoms crawling with the rebellion. Half the lords in the realm could not tell taxation from tyranny, and would bolt to the nearest usurper in a heartbeat, if it would save them a clipped copper. If that fails, you may well need to go to Bravas to treat with the Iron Bank yourself. Sir Harry's quailed. Must I? You are the master of coin, Lord Randall said sharply. I am. The puff of white hair at the end of Swift's chin quivered in outrage. Must I remind my lord, this trouble is not of my doing, and not all of us have had the opportunity to refill our coffers with the plunder of Maidenpool and Dragonstone. I resent your implication, Swift, Mace Tyrell said, bristling. No wealth was found on Dragonstone, I promise you. My son's men have searched every inch of that damp and dreary island, and turned up not so much as a single gemstone or speck of gold, nor any sign of this fabled hoard of dragon eggs. Kevin Lannister had seen Dragonstone with his own eyes. He doubted very much that Loras Tyrell had searched every inch of that ancient stronghold. The Valyrians had raised it, after all, and all their work stank of sorcery. And Sir Loras was young, prone to all the rash judgments of youth, and had been grievously wounded storming the castle besides. But it would not do to remind Tyrell that his favourite son was fallible. If there was wealth on Dragonstone, Stannis would have found it, he declared. Let us move along, my lords. We have two queens to try for high treason, you may recall. My niece has elected trial by battle, she informs me. Sir Robert Strong will champion her. The silent giant, Lord Randall grimaced. Tell me, sir, where did this man come from? Demanded Mace Tyrell. Why have we never heard his name before? He does not speak, he will not show his face. He is never seen without his armour. Do we know for a certainty that he is even a knight? We do not even know if he's alive. Meryn Trant claimed that Strong took neither food nor drink, and Boris Blunt went so far as to say he had never seen the man use the privy. Why should he? Dead men do not shit. Kevin Lannister had a strong suspicion of just who this Sir Robert really was, beneath that gleaming white armour. A suspicion that Mace Tyrell and Randall Tarly no doubt shared. Whatever the face hidden behind Strong's helm, it must remain hidden for now. The silent giant was his niece's only hope. And pray that he is as formidable as he appears. But Mace Tyrell could not seem to see beyond the threat to his own daughter. His grace named Sir Robert to the King's Guard, Sir Kevin reminded him. And Caban vouches for the man as well. Be that as it may, we need Sir Robert to prevail, my lords. If my niece is proved guilty of these treasons, the legitimacy of her children would be called into question. If Tommen ceases to be a king, Margaery will cease to be a queen. He let Tyrell chew on that a moment. Whatever Cersei may have done, she is still a daughter of the Rock, of mine own blood. I will not let her die a traitor's death. But I have made sure to draw her fangs. All her guards have been dismissed and replaced with my own men. In place of her former ladies-in-waiting, she will henceforth be attended by a scepter and three novices selected by the High Septon. She is to have no further voice in the governance of the realm, nor in Tommen's education. I mean to return her to Castle Rock after the trial, and see that she remains there. Let that suffice. The rest he left unsaid. Cersei was soiled goods now, her power at an end. Every baker's boy and beggar in the city had seen her in her shame, and every tart and tanner from Flea Bottom to Pisswater Bend had gazed upon her nakedness, their eager eyes crawling over her breasts and belly and women's parts.
No queen could expect to rule again after that. In gold and silk and emeralds, Circe had been a queen. The next thing, to a goddess. Naked, she was only human. An aging woman with stretch marks on her belly and teats that had begun to sag, as the shrews in the crowds had been glad to point out to their husbands and lovers. Better to live shamed than die proud, Sir Kevin told himself. My niece will make no further mischief, he promised Mace Tyrell. You have my word on that, my lord. Tyrell gave a grudging nod. As you say, my Marjorie prefers to be tried by the faith, so the whole realm can bear witness to her innocence. If your daughter is as innocent as you'd have us believe, why must you have your army present when she faces her accusers? Sir Kevin might have asked. Soon, I hope, he said instead, before turning to Grand Maester Pycelle. Is there aught else? The Grand Maester consulted his papers.
We should address the Rusby inheritance. 6 claims have been put forth.
We can settle Rusby at some later date. What else?
Preparation should be made for Princess Marcella.
That is what comes of dealing with the Dornish, Mace Tyrell said. Surely a better match can be found for the girl. Such as your own son, Willis, perhaps? Her disfigured by one Dornishman, him crippled by another. No doubt, Sir Kevin said, but we have enemies enough without offending Dorn. If Dorn Martell were to join his strength to Cunnington's in support of this feigned dragon, things could go very ill for all of us.
Mayhaps we can persuade our Dornish friends to deal with Lord Cunnington, Sir Harry Swift said, with an irritating titter. That would save a deal of blood and trouble.
It would, Sir Kevin said wearily. Time to put an end to this. Thank you, my lords. Let us convene again 5 days hence, after Circe's trial.
As you say, may the warrior lend strength to Sir Robert's arms.
The words were grudging. The dip of the chin, Mace Tyrell gave the Lord Regent the most cursory of bows. But it was something, and for that much Sir Kevin Lannister was grateful. Randall Tarley left the hall with his liege lord, their green cloaked spearmen right behind them. Tarley is a real danger, Sir Kevin reflected as he watched their departure. A narrow man, but iron-willed and shrewd, and as good a soldier as the Reach could boast. But how do I win him to our side?
Lord Tyrell loves me not,
Grand Maester Pycelle said in gloomy tones when the hand had departed.
This matter of the moon tea, I would never have spoken of such, but the Queen Dowager commanded me. If it pleased the Lord Regent, I would sleep more soundly if you could lend me some of your guards.
Lord Tyrell might take that amiss. Sir Harry Swift tugged at his chin beard.
I am in need of guards myself. These are perilous times.
I thought Kevin Lannister. And Pycelle is not the only council member our hand would like to replace. Mace Tyrell had his own candidate for Lord Treasurer, his uncle, Lord Seneschal of Highgarden, whom men called Garth the Gross. The last thing I need is another Tyrell on the small council. He was already outnumbered. Sir Harry's was his wife's father, and Pycelle could be counted upon as well. But Tarley was sworn to Highgarden, as was Paxter Redwine, Lord Admiral and Master of Ships, presently sailing his fleet around Dorne to deal with Euron Greyjoy's iron men. Once Redwine returned to King's Landing, the council would stand at 3-3, Lannister and Tyrell. The seventh voice would be the Dornish woman, now escorting Marcella home. The Lady Nym, but no lady, if even half of what Qyburn reports is true. A bastard daughter of the Red Viper, near as notorious as her father, and intent on claiming the council seat that Prince Oberon himself had occupied so briefly.